It is Monday, June the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Islamic State claiming responsibility for Saturday night attacks in London.
I mean, three attacks since March, and the Brits really have a problem with their Muslim community. Let's face it.
Also ahead, Russia's Putin on U.S. television, 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War.
The 67 war was transformative, both for Israel and the Palestinians.
Also ahead, two dynamic refugee documentaries. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. London police say seven people are dead, plus their attackers were shot dead. Many dozens more were wounded. All of this happened late Saturday. VOA's Luis Ramirez is in London with more.
This incident lasted slightly more than 8 minutes. That's when members of the public called police to report that a van had struck pedestrians on a street around the London Bridge. The van kept driving onto the nearby historic Borough Market, where the suspects jumped out of the vehicle and took knives and started stabbing a number of people. Police action very, very quick. The officers, are heavily armed officers, arrived and shot them dead. The suspects were found to be carrying what appeared to be, or wearing what appeared to be, suicide vests, canisters tied around their waist, around their torso. And, after they were shot, it was determined that those vests were fake. And so very quick police action here. The scene is still cordoned off, no one being allowed in or out. Police asking people who live in that area, those who have not been evacuated, because there were restaurants and hotels that were evacuated. But those who remain inside are being asked to stay inside and to stay in touch with police.
Authorities early on declared this a terrorist attack, and a bit later, Prime Minister Theresa May spoke outside number 10 Downing Street about the fight against extremism.
Since the emergence of the threat from Islamist-inspired terrorism, our country has made significant progress in disrupting plots and protecting the public. But it is time to say enough is enough. Everybody needs to go about their lives as they normally would. Our society should continue to function in accordance with our values. But when it comes to taking on extremism and terrorism, things need to change.
Prime Minister May went on to say there's far too much tolerance of extremism in Britain. And we asked terrorism analyst R. Nicholas Palerino if he agrees.
I certainly agree with her. Look, since March 22nd, they've had three attacks. The Westminster Bridge in March, the Manchester bombing, the London Bridge. I mean, three attacks since March. And the Brits really have a problem with their Muslim community. Let's face it. But it's not only the British who have a problem with their Muslim communities. It's also all of Europe that have a problem with their Muslim communities. But the problem doesn't just lie in the Muslim communities. It also lies with the refugees that are flooding into Europe. What they need to do is to eliminate these safe spaces from which the terrorists breed. I mean, that's so important. It's like a safe haven in a country overseas that allows terrorists to operate. Well, you have safe havens, if you will, or safe spaces in these communities from which these terrorists can breed and plan. So they're not just, you shouldn't just target the Muslim communities, but let's face it, that's where most of these attacks are emanating from. And on the internet, they also have to get tougher with Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth. Facebook is right. They really need to provide some type of protocol that eliminates all this hate speech that's coming out in Facebook and all, over all these other accounts. This is what's breeding all of this terrorism.
We also asked Pallarino if he can believe the Islamic State, which claimed responsibility for Saturday night's attacks, as they did for the suicide bombing in Manchester 2 weeks ago.
No, I would say that when they claim something, they are really, they're credible when they claim something. I believe it was the Islamic State. So we need to keep hammering. We need to get into Raqqa. We need to overtake Raqqa. We're going to need to eliminate that. We need to eliminate their presence in Mosul. But that's not going to stop them totally. You're going to have this ideology out there for a long time, so you really need to confront the ideology of this caliphate.
Terrorism analyst R. Nicholas Pallarino, he most recently was a professor at Georgetown University, specializing in research on radical jihad and existential threat to the international community. Well, people everywhere voice solidarity with the people of Britain following the attack Saturday night. President Trump spoke with Prime Minister May and offered any help that might be needed. Sunday, he spoke again here in Washington, saying the London attacks were, in his words, evil slaughter. Earlier on Sunday, London's Mayor Sadiq Khan spoke with reporters.
I'm appalled and furious that these cowardly terrorists would deliberately target innocent Londoners and bystanders enjoying their Saturday night. There can be no justification for the acts of these terrorists, and I'm quite clear that we will never let them win, nor will we allow them to cower our city or Londoners.
New Zealand's Defence Minister Mark Mitchell spoke before a news briefing about terrorism and the attacks in London.
We know that terror organisations look to galvanise support and exploit porous borders, disenfranchised individuals, and the access provided by the internet and social media. This is a clear and present security threat to us all, and there's no clearer reminder of this than the horrendous attacks we've seen in London. May I express our deepest sympathies to our friends in the United Kingdom.
And in Paris, French President Emmanuel Macron said France stands more than ever at Britain's side. The London attacks over the weekend came in a week that British voters go to the polls for parliamentary elections. Prime Minister May called the election when polls suggested her Conservative Party commanded a substantial lead over the second largest party, Labour. But since then, the polls have tightened considerably. VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with two British journalists, Toby Harnden, the Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times of London, and James Astle, the Washington correspondent for The Economist. She asked Harnden to explain the prime minister's thinking to call snap elections in the first place.
Well, I think she wanted to increase her parliamentary majority. She had a majority of, I think, 17. And going into the EU negotiations, she wanted to have more flexibility, not to be beholden to a small number of MPs, maybe on the hardline Brexit side, who might have sort of limited her room for manoeuvre. But it's one of those cases, a bit like David Cameron, be careful what you ask for, because it looks like at the moment that strategy may be backfiring.
Because she is not as high in the polls as
she thought. Well, she was about 21 points ahead coming in, and it was always natural that would come down. But there are some polls now that are putting it as close as 3 percentage points ahead. I mean, I think it's still a fairly faint possibility, but there could be a hung parliament where she has no absolute majority, in which she would be in the worst possible negotiating position.
James Astle, turning to you, anything to add or subtract to why Theresa May called these elections and where she stands in the polls to date?
No, I think Toby's absolutely bang on, but I mean, I just underline that Theresa May became prime minister after the trauma of the Brexit vote with an extraordinary kind of fair wind behind her. She was not well known in the country, though she was a veteran Tory politician who'd held important jobs in the cabinet, had been around for a long time. She seemed a reassuring presence, and she made a number of sensible moves as she became prime minister. She talked about reconnecting the party, which had been previously run under David Cameron, by well-educated, cosmopolitan, very metropolitan elite figures, reconnecting it to the sort of middle England voter that the Tory party had traditionally relied upon. And this went down extremely well. But what this current election campaign has done really is it mostly expose what a mediocre politician Theresa May is. She is not in command of the wide array of government policy. Her understanding of business and economics seem to be particularly poor. She's not sure-footed. She's not confident off her brief. And she's not a terribly attractive or charismatic figure either. So I think that that slide in the polls, that closing of the gap in the polls between Labour and the Tories that Toby referred to, is really a natural adjustment as voters come to terms with the fact that they knew the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and they didn't think very much of him. They didn't actually know the Prime Minister terribly well, and it turns out they don't think much of her either.
That's James Astle, Washington correspondent for The Economist. He and Toby Harnden, the Washington bureau chief for the London Times of London, the Sunday Times, that is, spoke with Carol Castiel, who is host of the VOA program Encounter. By the way, you can listen to Encounter on voanews.com. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin hardly spoke at all with former U.S. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn when they sat together at a Moscow dinner in 2015. That's what he told the NBC News program Sunday night with Megyn Kelly. Mr. Putin speaks here through an interpreter.
You and I personally have a much closer relationship than I had with Mr. Flynn. You and I met yesterday evening. You and I have been working together all day today, and now we're meeting again. When I came to the event for our company, Russia Today, and sat down at the table, next to me there was a gentleman sitting on one side. I made my speech, then we talked about some other stuff, and I got up and left. And then afterwards I was told, you know, there was an American gentleman, he was involved in some things. He used to be in the security services. That's it. I didn't even really talk to him. That's the extent of my acquaintance with Mr. Flynn.
President Putin speaking there through an interpreter in an interview conducted by NBC's Megyn Kelly on her program Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly. Flynn ties to Moscow are under scrutiny right now in the United States and allegations of possible Russian interference as well in the 2016 election. A frequently published photo of Flynn sitting next to Putin at a gala dinner seems to hint that they had close relations. Flynn has denied to testify before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee about his Russian ties, invoking his constitutional right to avoid self-incrimination. Later this week, former FBI Director James Comey, who was fired by President Trump, will testify before that committee about the Russia-Trump allegations which he was leading before he was fired. The U.S. House of Representatives also, along with a special counsel appointed by the Justice Department, are looking into allegations of collusion between the Trump presidential campaign and whether Russia influenced the voting toward Mr. Trump's win. During anti-Trump rallies over the weekend, a number of demonstrators called on Washington officials to appoint an independent investigator to look into the Russia-Trump allegations, someone they say who would not be politically partisan. Many of those same anti-Trump protesters also reacted to President Trump's announcement he was withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord. Demonstrations were underway in more than 135 cities in the U.S. and around the world. And in the U.S. city of Austin, Texas, the mayor, Steve Adler, spoke to the crowds.
What an incredibly crazy week we have just gone through. Beginning with climate change, it is outrageous. that the United States would pull out of that treaty, becoming one of three countries in the world not involved in that treaty. But I will tell you that we still are here in Austin, Texas.
Pro-Trump demonstrators also were out on the streets cheering Mr. Trump's decision to leave the Paris Climate Agreement. Today marks the 50th anniversary of a preemptive Israeli airstrike that destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground, paving the way for Israel to defeat Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. It became known as the Six-Day War. Many analysts agree the war transformed the balance of power in the Middle East. American University Professor Emeritus Russell Stone tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's one of them.
Well, the 67 war was transformative both for Israel and the Palestinians. We have to remember that at the outbreak of the war itself, it was an existential struggle for Israel. It was not clear that they were going to win, and they were under the threat of being annihilated. At least those were the words that were used at the time. So very quickly, planning for how to proceed with this sudden acquisition of territory and control over people would take place. That's the source of the discussions that went on in Israeli planning circles. For the Palestinians, it was also transformative. They before had been in the West Bank, basically occupied by Jordan, and in Gaza by Egypt, and suddenly found themselves in a new political reality for which they were not prepared.
This was truly a David and Goliath struggle. Israel hemmed in by enemies on all sides. What was the key to victory? Israeli military leadership?
Well, it was a combination of, I would say, luck and a severe determination on the part of the Israelis, who felt that their backs were really to the wall. They didn't know that they had military superiority. They didn't have superiority in terms of equipment or in terms of numbers. Their superiority was in terms of determination and commitment to fight and the ability to use the technology that they did have available, which was probably inferior to what Egypt had available at that time.
6 days after the conflict began, Israel had captured 5,900 square kilometers of the West Bank, the walled old city of Jerusalem, more than two dozen Arab villages on the city's eastern flank. It conquered the Golan Heights from Syria and Sinai and Gaza Strip from Egypt. What's changed 50 years on?
Well, 50 years on, there is now a Palestinian political entity that did not exist before. It grew incrementally. And with Israel's agreement, I'm not sure that they didn't often regret having permitted the emergence of a Palestinian political entity, but they did. And the Palestinians now have aspirations to a nationhood and a statehood of their own that they didn't have before. From the Israeli point of view, it's been managing a continuing occupation, which over time has grown in the sense that there are now Israeli settlements in the conquered territories, with the estimates are around 400,000 settlers living across the former Green Line, the former Armistice Line. What has happened in Gaza is that Israel decided to withdraw and give Palestinians the opportunity there to run their own affairs, which has resulted in a government the seizing of power by Hamas, which was not viewed favorably by the West Bank Palestinian administration and remains problematic for them as well as for Israel right up to today.
Here's how one article begins. Israelis and Palestinians mark 50 years since the Six-Day War as the gap between them widens, with both sides deeply scarred by years of violence, failed negotiations, and broken promises. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't know if it's an escalation of the situation. It certainly has been a 50-year period of very rocky relationships, and there's no resolution to it in sight.
Dr. Russell Stone of American Universities, whose expertise include Israeli and Palestinian societies, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO, have announced that they made a third detection of gravitational waves, which are described as ripples in the fabric of space-time. This is what a gravitational wave sounds like. The latest observation of gravitational waves were detected on January 4th at LIGO's two detector sites in Livingston, Louisiana and Hanford, Washington. As with the previous two detections, scientists say that the gravitational waves were generated after the violent fusion of two black holes. It's been determined that the merger of the black holes took place about 3 billion light years away. The unification of the two black holes has produced one with a mass 42 times that of our sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. With a continuing concern over the plight of Syria's refugees, two documentaries are shedding light on their hardships and how they are regarded by the world around them. Apo Bazidi's film Kobani, Resistance is Life, chronicles the siege of Kobani, a primarily Kurdish town in northern Syria that was seized by Islamic State militants in 2014, turning its inhabitants into refugees. Tonislav Ristrov's documentary, it's called The Good Postman, focuses on a dying Bulgarian village as its elderly inhabitants debate what to do with the refugees crossing into their lands from Turkey. We get the story now from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
In the summer of 2014, Islamic State launched one of its most violent and large-scale attacks on Kobani, a largely Kurdish city on the border of Syria and Turkey. The men and women resisted for 6 months. During the siege, thousands of people fled to Turkey. Among them, a family of five moved into a refugee camp in the Turkish town of Suruk. Eight-year-old Evelyn is the eldest of the children. Smart, engaging, Evelyn is the main character of this documentary, underscoring the storyline of the people of Kobani. Apo Bazidi's documentary Resistance is Life shows Kurdish fighters, men and women, pushing Islamic State out of Kobani. But the city lies in ruins. Many have returned to their destroyed homes, but tens of thousands, including Evelyn and her family, remain in a refugee camp. The threat of the extremists is still palpable in the region, and life is far from returning to normal. The documentary is a reminder that these people need help. Tonislav Hristov's documentary, The Good Postman, also looks at the refugee issue through European eyes and with a sense of irony. As the electoral campaign of three mayoral candidates heats up in a dying border Bulgarian village, the debate over Syrian refugees who cross illegally into their village daily intensifies. An unemployed, self-styled revolutionary is a populist candidate who longs for the older communist times and mixes utopian socialism with bigotry and xenophobia. But Ivan, the postman, the liberal candidate, offers a different proposal. Let the refugees settle in the village and revitalize it.
Syria, да се заселят, искам да се оживи.
Karle Aho, the film producer of the documentary, says the Bulgarian village is reflective of the Western world.
You don't have to go to a small Bulgarian village in order to find these characters. The same kind of politicians you have in Finland and Sweden, everywhere in Europe.
The Good Postman is as heartbreaking as it is funny, a searing satire of today's world. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
American singer Ariana Grande paid tribute to the city of Manchester, England on Sunday with an energetic, all-star concert that raised millions of dollars for the victims of a suicide bombing that tore through her last performance in the city nearly 2 weeks ago. Grande closed the three-hour-plus event with the song, a cover of Over the Rainbow. She cried on stage as the song ended and the audience cheered her on. Also performing on Sunday, among others, were Miley Cyrus, Pharrell, Justin Bieber, Katy Perry, and Liam Gallagher, formerly of Oasis. It was called the One Love Manchester Concert. It was aired across the globe, not only remembering the Manchester attack, but the Saturday night assaults in London as well. 60 pianos painted by artists and performers will be placed around New York City for anyone who wants to play them. I've been to this. You should go if you're in the area. A kickoff event for the street pianos will be held today in Lower Manhattan. The band leader for the CBS program Late Show with Stephen Colbert, John Batiste, will lead 60 pianists in playing Bach's Prelude in C, a magnificent event. Roberta Flack, one of my favorites, was one of those painting the pianos. Many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Patrick Dea, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the world's most promising and, in terms of economy, fastest-growing regions, sub-Saharan Africa, is under attack by transnational criminal networks. Corruption is one of their major weapons. Corruption is an abuse of power at every level that impacts rich and poor countries alike in both the private and public sectors. Corruption destroys trust, undermines development, and erodes confidence in democratic institutions. It distorts markets, causes higher prices, discourages investors, and stunts economic growth. And it is particularly destructive to communities in developing countries, where it blocks development and progress. As the criminal networks see it, you must spend money to make money, and that goes double for corruption. And transnational crime is tremendously lucrative, accounting for 8% to 15% of the world gross domestic product. Hundreds of millions of dollars every year enable criminals and other threat networks to corrupt the regional economies and the global financial system, said Senior Director for National Security and Diplomacy Anti-Crime Programs at the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, David Luna.
The proceeds of drug trafficking and other forms of illicit trafficking are fueling a dramatic increase in corruption among the very institution responsible for fighting crime. The collusion and complicity of some government officials with criminal networks have helped to carve out an illicit trafficking corridor that stretches from West Africa coast to the Horn of Africa, from North Africa south to the Gulf of Guinea.
Across these illicit routes, bad actors and networks are corrupting critical institutions and enforcement systems that endanger everyone's security, said David Luna. The United States is determined, in cooperation with our partners in Africa, to disrupt and dismantle transnational organized crime networks. In support of President Donald Trump's executive order on transnational criminal organizations, the United States will continue to assist our partners to strengthen their capabilities to combat today's threat networks, said Mr. Luna. We must crack down on corruption at all levels and cut off the ability of kleptocrats, criminals, and terrorists to enjoy the fruits of illicit enterprise and that enable the financial capacity to execute their operations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.